tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? 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 Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Why should we want to know? Well, because we're curious people. TV Jesus, and we're lifelong learners, and that's why we bring you KUOW's Week in Review. Happy, happy Friday. We're telling you what the buzz is. I'm Bill Radke. For the next hour, we're going to rewind the week gone by, and we'll tell you something you missed, you know? We'll tell you something that you never knew. I want to begin today with a question, if I may. We're going to be talking a little bit later this hour about regrets, and I need you, a dear listener. 1,000 older Americans were asked what they regret in life. I have strong feelings about their answers. We'll discuss, and I want you to be a part of the discussion. So think about it. What advice would you give your younger self based on your own regrets? For example, Stephanie, I asked this question earlier this week, and Stephanie said, don't give up learning a foreign language because you want a 4.0 GPA. Employers will care more that you speak Spanish than about your GPA. Good one, Stephanie. So my guests, Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com and columnist at Seattle Magazine. Knut, have you been thinking about regrets?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Wow, you really rose to
it. My life is full of them, yes.
You want to give us a hint for our later discussion?
For later? Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, when you get to be my age, the regrets are all stimulated by the preparation for death.
Oh.
You know, that's when you know you're really in middle age.
As a matter of fact, yeah, that definitely will come up in this discussion later on. C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox News. A whiff of regret, C.R.? Or do you have none?
Not enough train trips.
Okay. More on that to come. KUOW reporter Deborah Wong, are you having regrets right now that you're joining us for the first time?
Bill, je ne regrette rien.
Wow.
I have no regrets. I was born old. So I have always lived my life as if I'm an old person. So I regret nothing.
Love it. Stephanie maybe joined us on Facebook because, you know, we're KUOW Public Radio on Facebook. You can tweet at us at KUOW. We're online and on phone, 206-685-2526. That's 206-685-BLAM! Stay with us this hour on KUOW's Week in Review, and you will regret nothing. For this first topic, we are actually a panel plus one. We're joined by Todd Bishop of the Seattle-based tech news website, GeekWire. Todd, hi.
It's great to be here, Bill.
We invited you because of this week's top story. It's been a little over 24 hours now since Microsoft announced its biggest layoff ever, up to 18,000 jobs, most of them not in the Puget Sound area, but 1,300 or so are. And that's 3% of their local workforce, and that's a lot of people out of work. What has yesterday and this morning been like in Redmond?
You know, it's been a little bit nerve-wracking for Microsoft employees, especially yesterday morning. The trigger was if you had a meeting invite in your inbox inviting you to one of many conference rooms staffed by HR professionals, you knew that the axe was about to fall.
And I would just decline that appointment request. Just hit decline.
Let's see if that works.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the company is offering relatively generous severance packages, and I think that helps quite a bit to ease the blow and give folks months to find a job. But, you know, losing one's job is never easy. And the big question now for a lot of people who still remain is the remaining layoffs. And Microsoft has signaled that it will be trying to notify everyone over the next 6 months and hopefully sooner for those folks. But it can be a little nerve-wracking around the office knowing that you might actually still be on the hook to be let go.
Why? I thought they gave a very specific number, 1,351 people.
That's exactly right.
So why are there remaining layoffs?
Just the first wave. There are some divisions such as the Windows and the operating system group that are not far along they're not as far along as some of the other groups in terms of changing the way they do business. So in particular in that group, there could be more cuts to come.
Okay, so we have a lot of other tech companies here. Are all these Microsofties just going to get snapped up?
Possibly, and in fact, sort of hot off the presses here, we just had a little scoop this morning. Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce giant, is opening an outpost here in the Seattle region just in advance of its initial public offering, and they're recruiting heavily mobile developers. So that is just one example of the many companies that have entered the Seattle market, recruiting many of the same people that Microsoft is now going to be laying off.
Talking to GeekWire's Todd Bishop about this yesterday's Microsoft layoff announcement, I've got a million questions for you. Anybody else?
Well, Todd, this email that went out yesterday, so the layoffs were announced by Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, who sent out this email that really talked about why the layoffs will be occurring, the new strategic direction of the company. But it was kind of bloodless in the sense that it didn't really acknowledge that this is going to be an incredibly painful thing for so many people. I mean, 18,000 people. This was far larger than anyone had ever had predicted. Is that the way that layoffs happen in the tech world, that they're all about strategy and they're not really, nothing personal?
Yes. It's a difficult position because you're communicating not only to the people who are going to be let go, but actually even more so to the people who are going to be sticking around. And because of that, it can come off sometimes as a little bit cold. I think Satya Nadella is in a tough spot here. He's been on the job for 5 months, and this is really the first major action that he's taken. So I agree with you. It was something that came off as a little bit cold for people who've been let go, but that is the way it operates sometimes.
Todd, it strikes me that there's more behind this than just simple cost-cutting, downsizing, which, we see at different corporations, that, as you say, this is the first act of the new CEO. He talked about streamlining the corporation, getting rid of layers of management, doing things differently. Do you see this as not just integrating Nokia and getting rid of a few people, but changing the direction of the company, having it be not Steve Ballmer's Microsoft, not even Bill Gates's Microsoft, but something very different?
Absolutely. That is really what this is about. If you look at Microsoft's layoffs back in 2009, that was really about cost cutting and appeasing Wall Street in the middle of the recession. This is much more about aligning the company with Satya Nadella's vision and his engineering expertise actually coming through. For a decade, you had Steve Ballmer, the real business guru, running the company. Nadella brings a different perspective as somebody who has actually been in the trenches with the company's engineers. And the hope, I think, among a lot of Microsoft shareholders and employees is that this streamlining effort, this attempt by him to make cuts that make decisions faster down the road, will actually change Microsoft's culture. And that really is the big question.
Knut Berger, this ain't our first big local company layoff. How does this seem to compare?
Well, it's not even Microsoft's first layoff, although they're fairly new to the cycle. And the big one, the mother of all layoffs, was Boeing during the recession between 1968 and 1971. Boeing shed over 60,000 jobs, most of them in Puget Sound. We had 17% unemployment. So it gives you a sense of the scale.
By the way, unemployment just came out. It was, in the Seattle area, something like 4.8%, statewide 5.8%, something like that. So it's a different situation.
The contrast is interesting because if you're looking at 1,300 jobs immediately and then some percentage of another 5,000, I think, over the next year. I've been out on the Olympic Peninsula and some of the more economically distressed areas where there's still 10 and 9% unemployment in some of these counties, where the top employer only employs maybe 500 or 600 people total. And so it gives you a sense of not only the scale of Microsoft, but also the scale of the kind of job loss that this market can absorb because of the growth. My question for Todd would be, is this something so specific to Microsoft? I mean, companies go through those boom years where, Microsoft laid people off in 2009, but then they've gotten bigger. Now they're cutting down. What is it? Does it bode anything for companies like Amazon that are also in that inflationary employment period? Are we looking at a downsizing in other sectors coming up?
Amazon is such a unique beast, and they have seen just astronomical growth. They're upwards of 125,000 people globally, and that is just, it's tens of thousands more than they employed a year ago. And so for Amazon, I would say it's more of a cautionary tale to look at Microsoft and say, hey, let's not, you know, get too far out ahead of the skis, and let's, you know, probably be a little more logical about our growth. For the broader economy, I think Microsoft is actually pretty unique here. I don't think this signals the potential for future layoffs at other companies more than we would see otherwise.
Todd Bishop here with GeekWire. Finally, Todd, what's your advice to a Microsoftie who got one of those appointment requests yesterday?
Learn how to code for the iPhone and Android. I think that would be the key. You know, that's really a large part of where the market is headed, and I think diversifying skills is going to be key for anybody at Microsoft or anybody else.
From the Seattle-based tech news website, GeekWire, always good to talk with you, Todd Bishop.
Thank you, Bill.
We'll keep following this, Microsoft's announcement yesterday of the job losses, 18,000 total, but the oddly specific 1,351 in the Seattle area. The layoffs appear to be in response to tonight's planned construction on Interstate 90. The DOT is asking us not to go to work, and Microsoft just made that easier for 1,351 people. In a moment, why should you pay a toll for obeying the state DOT and using the other bridge? That's coming up next on KUOW's Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. Hi, I'm Bill Radke with some good news. Next week, if you commute by car, you'll have the opportunity to spend even more time listening to KUOW. Interstate 90 will skinny down to one lane between Bellevue Way Southeast and the East Channel Bridge. From tonight at 9:30 till 5 a.m. next Friday, and that's around the clock. That's rush hour included. They're replacing a couple of enormous expansion joints. And in response, authorities are asking you, please buy a bicycle or go on vacation or stay home or sell your home and move to a different part of America or use an alternate route. Use 405 or 522 or just in. There's actually another floating bridge that also goes across the same lake. That would be 520, except, funny thing, if you use that bridge to help out your fellow commuter and do what you're asked, you will be rewarded by having to pay the 520 toll. CR, why didn't they just suspend the toll for 1 week?
Because it would be a policy that would be almost impossible to write. I mean, if you have one lane of I-90 closed or down to one lane, and you say, okay, then you give a toll holiday on 520. Well, what if in 6 months they have to close not one lane but two lanes of 90? So, I mean, you two lanes open, so you'd have some backup, but not this much backup.
Make it a one-lane policy. Simple. How's that?
Do you do a toll holiday then? What if, you know, you get a semi that crashes on I-90, blocks lanes during rush hour?
No, it doesn't count. Only when it's one lane and it's a planned closure and you're asking people to use another route. How's that for a rule?
I think it would be very difficult, and I wouldn't be the one wanting to write the policy of how to deal with that. I also don't have a ton of sympathy for I-90 commuters who will have to pay a toll for a week if they choose to use that route. I mean, listen, they've had a toll holiday ever since that thing was open.
Oh, now it's a holiday if other people have a toll and you don't?
They have not had to pay any of that bridge's construction cost or the upgrades or for the wear and tear, which is what the expansion joints are about.
You know, Roosevelt Way, you can drive that thing for free right now because you're on holiday as well.
520 folks have had to pay each time they put a new bridge in. So I don't see how, if they want to use 520 and have to contribute to the region's transportation system, that's a bad thing.
Well, just for the record, the old floating bridge did have a toll on it. It was taken off when it was paid for.
It was the original
floating bridge, not the new I-90 bridge, but the original.
The Murrow? Oh.
Yeah. It had a toll plaza on the Mercer Island side.
I think we're thinking about this the entirely the wrong way. I think we should be looking at this like a snow day, you know, when there's going to be a snowcopalypse or snow, mm-hmm. snowopalypse or whatever we call it, snow apocalypse. Whatever that word is.
Or in the Seattle area, it always turns out to be no big deal after we've built it up. But
So emergency first responders come out and say, look, stay off the roads. Don't go to work. Don't go to school. Leave the roads open for snowplows and emergency vehicles. Why don't we do that for next week? So it's not it's not the responsibility of employees to stay off the roads or to find an alternate route. Just stay off the roads. Stay home, telecommute, use your phone, use your internet connection. I mean, in this day and age, why can't we do that for a week?
Because you might be a landscaper working on an hourly
basis. Right, so
the folks who need to get to work,
go to work. But people who work in offices who don't have to go to work, don't go to work.
But that generally is what happens, is that they, you know, play up the kind of carpocalypse kind of deal. And this happened with Highway 99, too. And then people do that. People find alternate ways. We lost the floating bridge to a storm once, and everything had to go on 520. And it was a major hassle, and a lot of people found alternate routes or other ways. So you just kind of work around it. I think the toll policy thing is interesting because it seemed as if the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing, that the Transportation Commission says that it didn't know that this was happening, so it didn't have a chance to even consider. I frankly think it would take something more than inconvenience for them to shut down the tolls on 520 because even with the tolling, they don't have enough money to finish that project. They want every dime they can possibly squeeze out of folks to help offset what we already know is to be huge cost overruns.
Are you guys all Seattle people? How will this affect your lives next week, if at all?
I actually live on the east side and commute.
Okay. So what are you going to do?
Is I will probably stay a couple nights in the city next week. I will
come to my place. I got an extra room.
I will change my behavior, and this goes to what Knut said. With forewarning, it does affect what people do. I mean, not just 99, but I'm not sure if you referenced I-5, but same kind of thing happened a couple years ago. I-5 is supposed to be Carmageddon, and it was disrupted, but not nearly as planned. Mm-hmm. I mean, people do go to carpooling, maybe stay a night or two in the city, maybe telecommute, maybe take a vacation day. I mean, forewarning works. It does change behavior.
Don't forget, though, Tuesday is when President Obama will be in town for a fundraiser, and he's only going to be in Seattle. But you know, every time he comes to town, they shut down the freeways when he goes in and out of the airport. So even if you live in Seattle, if you don't live on the east side, do not use the freeway on Tuesday.
A KOW recommends you steal someone's windshield for their good-to-go pass. That's the other indignity. If you don't have a good-to-go pass, you got to pay the extra high mail-in
toll. Well, I was going to say it's like 2 to 3 times higher without that stupid thing.
Traffic might keep some East Siders away from a Gilbert and Sullivan play now at Seattle Center, but there are other reasons not to go. As you'll hear next on KOW's Week in Review.
I want to shake my Savior's hand.
I'm building my hope
from things eternal.
I'm working on the road to glory.
Three little bits from school are we. What does the schoolgirl will give me? Filled to the brim with girlish glee. Three little bits from school.
KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Tonight, the Bagley Wright Theater presents Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado. Showtime is 7:30 p.m. Archaic stereotypes begin at 7:31 p.m. The Mikado is a 130-year-old comic opera. It's not about Japan. It's a satire of British bureaucrats that happens to be set in an 1880s English idea of the exotic Far East, with characters acting like British buffoons, but in kimonos and with black wigs and paper fans and all the simplistic Orientalist images. Or so I've read. I've never seen The Mikado. Our next special guest has. Roger Tang is a Seattle theater veteran, a producer, a playwright, executive director of the theater group Pork-Filled Players, editor and publisher of the Asian American Theater Review. Roger, welcome.
No, thanks. Thanks for having.
You have not seen this production of The Mikado, right?
No, I have not.
You're going when? Do you have plans?
Yes, I'm going to see it on Sunday.
Sunday, okay. Are we paying for your ticket?
No.
You should hook that up. We'll do that. How do you feel going in?
Well, I'm keeping an open mind. I read the libretto. I'm gonna be honest and say I don't see anything specifically about Japan in there, and like any other production, you can do it well, or you can do it poorly.
Well, there are no, so I'm told, zero actors of Asian descent in this production. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's basically, for me, it's like it's an old story told again. It happens a lot around the country that characters that are written as Asian are played by white people. And that might be an excuse if there are no Asian actors available. But in this country, there are lots of Asian actors. In this town, there are a lot of Asian actors. Even in New York, where there's the mecca of theater across the country, the actual population in the New York area is around 16% Asian American. But Asian actors only play 3% of the roles. And of that time, it's only their roles are written to be Asian. So it's not very often that they are cast in non-specifically Asian roles.
Is there anything this production could do to make this 130-year-old play more relevant and appropriate?
Well, there's all sorts of ways you can go about it, and that's up to the imagination of the director and the producers. For one example, if you really wanted to be, you know, take hold of the Japan motive, you can use some of the motives, like go a manga route.
Manga, yes.
Yes. You know, their version of, you know, of comic books. Mm-hmm. Or you can use some other aspects of Japanese life, like Japanese corporations. If you don't want to, you don't have to use Japan at all, actually, because very little in the libretto works with depends on being in Japan. You can put it, for example, in the internet.com era where internet mogul will take over a country and is ruling a country and according to their ideas. And some of the names become .com names.
Any other questions for Roger?
I should say, first of all, in full disclosure, that this was one of the first musicals I ever saw as a kid back in Chicago. So I have actually a soft spot in my heart for this performance. Did you read Sharon Chan's editorial in the Seattle Times, because that's sort of what started this whole controversy. She claims that the performance of the Mikado is sort of like using blackface in the old days, white actors using blackface to portray African Americans, and she is very, you know, very much against using these sorts of stereotypes. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that that's a fair judgment?
Is a judgment based on what's actually being shown? I mean, from what I saw of the publicity photos, there's some problematic areas that,
like what?
For example, in a couple of the scenes, a couple of the actors are shown with some very exaggerated makeup to make them look like they have slanted eyes, and at least to me, and I don't think that's really appropriate. Also, if you're trying to put on dye your hair and straighten your hair when your hair isn't actually that's, you know, straight or black, that's a little problematic. Also, there are a couple of poses where it looked like the actor is looking like he's trying to be an extra in a 1930s serial. All he needed was a bunch of three-inch nails to complete the picture.
A reporter, Deborah Wong, you're Chinese-American?
Yes.
Where are you coming from in this whole thing?
I think people do draw the line in different places. I don't easily take offense at these sorts of things. So I don't find this play offensive. I also do think that, you know, it's a question that I have. Can you take historical works, I mean, things from eras when sensibilities were different, and restage them faithfully? Or do we have to recast everything in a modern sensibility? I mean, that's sort of a question I have for you, Roger. Is it, you know, because we still read books from eras where sensibilities were different. We still look at fine art. They continue to exist and interest us. Is theater something different because it's a live performance? Do we have or can we? I mean, I think in the Gilbert and Sullivan Society's point is they keep these historical works alive. Can you still do that without having to recast them?
It's a very difficult thing to do, in my estimation. I mean, I think you. If you're very clear about that, this is what the it was done. If you're trying to do it, preserve it, you have to be very clear that it has all the attitudes back in the 19th century, and be very clear what the attitudes are.
This may be obvious, but will you explain why it is so sensitive for you? A portrayal of a sort of supposedly benign, you know. A portrayal, even if it's old-fashioned. Why does it matter so much?
Well, it matters so much is that it comes up again and again and again. We've been refighting these battles for, ever since Asian Americans started to get organized. It's the 21st century, and things have been going on since 1960. So that's like 45 years that we've been talking about this, and we've been saying the same things over and over again. So sometimes it gets a little tiring to try to get people to understand why it's hurtful, and one of the reasons is that the stereotypes have been used in order to to oppress Asian Americans. I mean, some of the same images were used in the evacuation of Japanese Americans during World War II. So I just don't like seeing that come up again and again and again.
I want to give the white people a chance. CR or Canute?
Do you think it matters that it's whites playing versus Asians playing these parts? I mean, if you had an all-Asian cast, it strikes me that it's not just about the yellow face aspect to it, but if you had Asians playing all these parts, there is still built into this whole score and story a caricature. It's meant to be very over-the-top caricature of sort of an Asian culture. And even if you have Asians playing the caricature, wouldn't that still be a problem?
I'm going to say that it there's very little about Asia in the libretto. It is meant to be a caricature of England. You have a danger of if you're trying to be absolutely faithful to Japanese society, you have this danger of saying, well, okay, it's going to become a cultural drag show. I think if you make it clear that there is, like a multicultural component, there are white people, there are Asian people, there are brown people, black people in the cast, you sort of reduce that danger of stereotyping Asians.
Roger, we need to move on to other topics. Go, will you let us know what you think of the show when you see it?
I certainly will.
Okay. Roger Tang, Seattle theater veteran. His T-shirt says Pork-Filled Players. He's the executive director, editor, and publisher of the Asian American Theater Review. Thanks for coming in. Great to meet you.
Thanks for having me in.
Again, that's The Mikado, Like It or Not. It's scheduled for performances at Seattle's Bagley Wright Theater through July 26th.
Nobody's Asian in the movies. Nobody's Asian on TV. If there is a part there for us, it's a ninja, a physician, or a goofy mathematician, or a groupie in the chorus. That's me.
There's that music. This is KUOW's A Week in Review. Just ahead, marijuana may be legal, but it ain't cool to be the Seattle city attorney and buy pot while you're working and take it back to your office. He'll tell you, well, we'll tell you what happened next, just ahead.
Do they want before they want an Asian, a Persian, or a Cajun, or an Indian, or an American Indian, played by a Mexican, or if you're lucky, someone Asian like me.
KUOW's Week in Review with C.R. Douglas and Canute Berger and KUOW reporter Deborah Wong running through the big stories of the week. And as I mentioned to you, we're going to talk in a few minutes here about regrets. And I asked you what advice you would give your younger self. We heard from Dave, who tweeted to his younger self. I hope his younger self has a Twitter account. He tweeted, "Get yourself on a budget and shun consumer debt. live within your means. What advice would you give your younger self, and what regrets do you plan to have later in your life? Share with us on KUOW's Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. You can tweet at KUOW, or you can give us a call, 206-685-2526, 206-685-CLAM, 685-AJAM, 685-BLAM. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you with us. We also heard on the subject of regrets, a listener named Pete Holmes says, I regret making a big public deal of buying marijuana. Not really. But last week, Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes made a splash at the opening of Seattle's first retail marijuana shop.
Today, marijuana sales became legal, and I'm here to personally exercise myself this new freedom.
Too much freedom, Pete. You don't have that much freedom. You're a city employee. You don't drink at work, do you? Now, the city attorney has apologized for buying marijuana on his work time and bringing a bag of marijuana back to his office, violations of city policy. As penance, Holmes said, says he has volunteered to donate $3,000 to the Downtown Emergency Service Center. Voluntarily. C.R. Douglas, is the city of Seattle saying that it's not enforcing its rules on employee marijuana conduct?
No, I think with public officials, it's not totally clear what policies they are bound by and what they aren't. But if he was found to have violated the policy, and my guess is there'll be some kind of investigation, the typical punishment is, for sort of a salaried employee, a week of no pay. Apparently that's happened with some people who brought marijuana on city property. So he is, I think, kind of headed that off by just imposing self-discipline by saying, hey, I'll give up a week of pay, which is the $3,000.
Why not just give up the week of pay and have it not be this question of enforcing it?
I don't think you can actually, it's not that easy to reduce your pay. we actually found that in some furloughs and stuff. So I think the easiest way for him to do it was just take the money and give it to a charity. I think he hopes that probably heads off any investigation. I think it's appropriate for him to have to live by the same rules as a city employee. Again, electeds are a little different, ultimately accountable to voters. They don't have a boss that he gets reviewed by every year or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he's a different animal.
Knut Berger, any thoughts?
It's just especially embarrassing. I mean, I had no problem with the idea of the city attorney buying legal. I think it was making a statement about the fact that we our attitudes are changing and have to change. So I had no problem with that. I didn't realize at the time that he was actually, you know, violating the rules, and especially taking it back to the office, which I find both kind of amusing and. And I mean, I agree with CR. He should, you know, be subject to whatever those rules are. But it's interesting because the city voters voted to tell the police not to enforce rules. Mm. So there's this way in which pot is still kind of tangled in this cultural shift and legal shift. It's still illegal federally, but legal in the state. You can't take it on city property, but we told the city police not to arrest anybody for pot. You know, there are all kinds of little tripwires in this whole thing. And it's just sort of funny that the guy who should know the law the best tripped over it.
By the way, you don't mind him, you know, making a show of buying some marijuana, but and I'm not making this up. I really don't know my equivalencies. I'm sure I'll learn. But the amount of pot that he bought would be equivalent to buying, if there's any kind of comparison, how much alcohol? I mean, if he'd have held up a case of beer, it would have been a little weird, right? I mean, given that there's problems with drugs. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, Seattle Mayor Fred Dorr used to, you know, go down and serve beer to the sailors visiting Seattle during Navy Week, you know, and there are pictures of him, you know, and these crowded bars and whatnot. And we've had mayors who have been big nightlife promoters and wanting the bars to be open 24 hours. I don't think it's a problem that way.
I think Knut's right that this does bring up a lot of issues about what's allowed and what isn't. We should be clear that 502, the law that legalized marijuana, didn't say anything about what employers can and can't do. You could still drug test if you're an employer. You can still drug test for alcohol if you're an employer. That is not illegal. The only thing 502 changed is that you can't be put in jail for small amounts. Mm-hmm. It said nothing about what companies, both public and private, can do. And we're realizing that that's not going to change as fast, that there are still places that are going to be drug-free workforces, no matter whether the drug is legal.
Yeah.
There's a criminal prosecution.
We're all learning. Man, that was such a huge deal last week. What a landmark. Retail marijuana stores are open. It's a whole new world. Hey, let's get in on this life-changing event by buying some pot. I'll call that marijuana shop, Cannabis City. Hello, I'd like some marijuana, please.
Our store is currently out of stock. We are pending a reopen date of July 21st.
Oh, they ran out? Have you seen protests? I mean, we made it such a big deal of legal pot stores opening. They run out of supply in 3 days, and no one really cares, right? It's like, how big a deal is legalization?
Well, I mean, for people who really want marijuana, probably a fairly big deal. But
they
the
can
rest,
get it somewhere else.
Well, and
can't
there's
they?
All there were also a lot of people in lines at these stores who, when they were interviewed, they said, you know, they were there because it was historic, because they believed in the idea that pot should be legal, that people should not be put in jail for smoking marijuana, but that they themselves were not, you know, big smokers. It was just a really great idea for them. So I don't think there's like there are people that are going to be like banging down the fences of all of these pot farms waiting for their weed. I don't think that probably, you know, describes most of the people in the state.
These are pot smokers, Bill Radke. Uh-huh. They do not get up and do huge protests. Pot smokers weren't even the ones that fought for Initiative 502. 502 was led and fought by attorneys and a whole bunch of law enforcement people. And a lot of the hardcore pot smokers, certainly in the medical marijuana community, didn't even like 502. Felt like it didn't go far enough. So these are not people that are going to pick it. These are people that I guess they feel like they've waited patiently for prohibition for years.
And they also have their dealers' phone numbers in their on the side. So.
There you go. Coming up on KUOW's Week in Review, Joe McCarthy was right. Washington State is being overrun by socialists. The actual details to that may surprise you. Stay tuned. And by surprise you, I mean not true. I'm Bill Radke with KUOW's Week in Review with KUOW reporter Deborah Wong and C.R. Douglas and from Q13. And the Mossback is here, Knut Berger. Seattle got its first socialist city council member in Kshama Sawant. Next thing you know, minimum wage is $15. Eventually. Now another socialist candidate is challenging not just any Washington state legislator, but the Speaker of the House, Frank Chopp. Reporter Deborah Wong, is this a socialist wave?
The socialists hope that this is a socialist wave. It has yet to be seen. So the person we're talking about is Jess Speer, and she was one of the main organizers of the group 15 Now. That's the group that was advocating for an aggressive $15 an hour wage and that threatened to take it to the ballot. She's also a member of the Socialist Alternative Party, which is the party of City Council member Kshama Sawant. And interestingly, it only has about 100 members. So we hear about the Socialist Alternative. It's a tiny little party. Sawant, since she was elected, she has been pushing and pushing for the idea that more socialists need to be running for office.
Yep.
And because she said, look at the difference that having one socialist on the Seattle City Council has made. Look at all these things that have happened, the $15 an hour wage among them. And that probably wouldn't have happened so quickly if she had not been there, because she has been this kind of, you know, dogged, aggressive campaigner for these issues. Now, whether or not Jess Speer can succeed in unseating the Speaker of the House, I guess you could call that a long shot. I sort of wish the Strangers, Eli Sanders, was here, because interestingly enough, the Stranger did not endorse Jess Speer. They're a huge Kshama Sawant fan, but they decided to endorse Frank Chopp. So,
right.
So that's one big strike against her, not having the Stranger in her corner.
That was pretty sobering, wasn't it, for the Stranger to be saying, a socialist in the legislature, who needs them? You know, they're not going to move the conservative Democrats or certainly the Republicans. Whoa.
Well, I think it's a good point.
It's obviously true.
Yeah, we have a city council that is basically made up of progressive Democrats, and we have a Democratic mayor.
Yeah.
So when you have someone who enters that institution on the left, it makes sense that she would sort of push the institution to the left. What will one socialist, legislator do in the state? I mean, I think the point is, even if she doesn't win, this is how Shama Sawant started. She ran against Frank Chop in 2012. She lost that race, but took her campaign apparatus, turned it around, ran for city council, and won the next year. So it could be the start of something for Joe Spear.
Yeah, well, certainly a socialist would look at the 43rd district and see it as very tempting if you overlaid it onto where Shama Sawant got most of her votes. The high vote percentages in places like Fremont, Wallingford, the U district, parts of the central area, and Capitol Hill. It's sort of the center of lefty Seattle. Frank Chop, some people have been critical of him as an incrementalist or as somebody who spends a lot of time cultivating moderate Democrats in suburban or rural districts to try and cobble together and hold a majority in the House. So there's a way in which this kind of a candidacy keeps complacency from setting in. But realistically, it's a completely different job than the city council job. It's a completely different political dynamic. And I think the Stranger endorsement and others, I mean, it would be a case of Seattle cutting its throat, to get rid of somebody like Frank Chop, particularly at the point in time where we're not only looking at can the Democrats regain control of the Senate, but can they maintain control of the House? And I think there's a pragmatism there that is an argument pretty hard to dispute.
C.R. Douglas, did Shama Sawant's victory and $15 an hour light a fire under a socialist pot, or was it an escape valve for letting off socialist steam and now the pot cools, in my pot analogy? Are we stirring the socialist roux, or are we letting it thicken and will it stick to the side of the pot?
Wow. To add another metaphor at risk of like having this whole thing topple over, I think it's the high water mark. I think $15 victory in Shama's election. I think for a couple reasons. You're already seeing a bit of a backlash. I mean, just this week we had the woman who brought you legal pot, Allison Holcomb, considering a serious challenge to Shama Sawant, saying, I share your values, basically, but I have a better style. I'm not as divisive, all the rest. So Sawant's already kind of now a little bit on the defensive. I think the Stranger choosing to side with Frank Chop and not Jess Spear is huge in terms of kind of the ability for the socialist revolution to continue. I think finally, nothing is going to match 15 now in terms of capturing public attention, the slogan, the pent-up demand for it. I don't think the next thing has that cachet. Rent control is what's talked about. Important. I get the reasons behind it. You can't banner that the same way. You can't fast food worker strike that the same way. You can't bumper sticker that. I don't see how they follow up 15 now with anything like that.
I don't know. With rents going up in Seattle the way they are, I think there's a lot of discontent about housing issues in the city.
All right. Fascinating. And we're going to find out. We're going to move on in a moment. What regrets are you planning to have about your life? I regret my socialist saucepan metaphor, for example. What advice would you give your younger self next on KUOW's Week in Review? KUOW's Week in Review with KUOW reporter Deborah Wong, Q13 Fox News political analyst C.R. Douglas, from Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine, the Mossback Knute Berger. And you, I'm Bill Radke. We asked you a few minutes ago about regrets, and Stephen has written us at weekinreview@kuow.org. I repeat, weekinreview@kuow.org. Stephen says, my regret and what I advised all my kids, don't get married until you're 40 or older. My first marriage was when I was 20. I'd like to hear more about that, Steve. I'll buy you a beer. Sam tweeted us and saying, THC and Petco do not mix. Mice look cute but smell bad. Again, Sam, I want to know far more, but we'll talk more about regrets in a moment. I want to welcome, speaking of regrets, Luke Burbank is here. Now, wait a minute.
Hey, everybody.
Wait, what I mean is, Luke from Livewire Radio on KUOW, which is a variety show, would you say, Luke?
I think so. Can I start off with a regret I have about this particular episode of Week in Review?
Mm-hmm.
In all of this talk about the traffic nightmares in the Northwest, nobody's even talking about Ottermageddon.
Tell me more.
Which, well, we've had a lot of river otter crossings up here in Port Townsend.
Oh,
right, sure. In front of Sport Townsend, the sporting goods store. You obviously saw it in the Port Townsend Leader.
Of course.
And it is really throwing a wrench into things. So I just want you to know we're all suffering.
Yeah, the DOT is asking you, please, make other otter-related plans. Yes.
That's all.
Luke, I just got back from New York City, and in a moment I want us to decide what's the best city in America for a summer vacation, and I want to hear from you, because you've spent time, you've been in New York, you've lived in L.A. and Seattle and Silverdale, so uh-huh. I feel like you can kind of help referee this. But before we get there, we're going to talk regrets. I was on vacation, as I said, the last week or so, and I tried to stay away from the news. I tried, but I was at a hotel, so of course a stack of USA Today's was right there on the concierge desk, and it was free. USA Today, because it's free.
USA Today, because you've got to step over something as you leave the hotel room.
USA Today, because you're waiting for your boarding pass to print. So, of course, on the front page is a survey of Americans age 60 and older. And I could not stop myself from reading the top five regrets that they have. And they wish they had, number one, saved more money. Number two, taken better care of my health. Number three, made better investments. Number four, kept legal documents more organized. Number five, stayed closer with family. All of which, of course, have to do with aging. I'm thinking, like, of course you had your legal documents. You know, you wish you had your legal documents in order because it's that time to wish that. You wish you had stayed closer with the people who are not visiting you. And I want to tell my older self, older Bill Radke, the reason you don't have more money is because you spent it when you were younger and in better health and able to enjoy it, and you've forgotten how much you loved that. So my question to you is, what do you plan to regret when you're old?
Well, I'm so with you, Bill, on the money stuff. Like, I want to coast in on fumes.
Right.
I mean, that's like, to
that's
me, it's
goal.
Like if you die the day that your, you know, accountant calls you to tell you you're out of money, you nailed it.
You win.
As a
game of life.
Indeed, you can be a winner at the game of life. So that part of it, I don't really agree with. The family stuff and the stuff about keeping relationships going, I think that that's probably the more valuable stuff to think about. Like, for me, I don't know if this exactly satisfies your question, and it's not a funny answer, but I think that if I was talking to Luke Burbank from 15 years ago, I would say, and what I'm hoping is that ancient me, first of all, they've found a cure for death by the time ancient me is around, so this is kind of moot. But I hope ancient me will have been able to experience me doing a better job of this. But I would say my regret at this point is that I've gone through much of my life not being present enough and also not seeing other human beings as human beings with their own hopes and dreams. They're just like things that are either blocking me get to my goal or helping me get to my goal.
Yes, pieces on your personal chessboard.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So knight to pawn three. Is that even a thing? I've actually never been able to grasp chess. But so I hope that is a thing that I'm not saying when I'm 85 years old, back to the previous Luke Burbank. I'm hoping that whether I have money or I have professional acclaim or I have any of those other things, I learn better how to interact with other people as I go through my life.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's really an answer.
Amen. Others? Anybody have any regrets? Let's see, Knut, yours was aging related.
Well, I can all of the things that the 60-year-olds are saying that they would tell their younger self are things my mother told me already.
You know?
And
she
I
was your older
to her
self
either. Yes, exactly. And you know, I instead of saving money, I spent it, and you know, my files are a mess. Yeah, a lot of it's trade-offs. You know, I had an opportunity years ago to go to work at Microsoft. I could have been maybe one of those Microsoft millionaires. I chose not to. I think I'm happier because of that. But there's always a part of you. When you've lived a while, there's always a part of you that kind of, oh, the path not taken, because you can fantasize about what it might have been like, and you don't have to think about all the worries it might have brought you.
Former Beatles drummer Pete Best has tweeted us. yes, you are?
I would have used more Rogaine.
Uh-huh.
And if you're a viewer of Q13 Fox, you know why I say that.
It paid off, I'm telling you.
I think, you know, I've been pretty work obsessed. And I think if you say what would I have done differently, maybe it takes off a little bit in what Luke says. But, you know, friends, unfortunately, have been kind of the first thing to go a little bit in my life as I focus on all these professional things. Not that they're gone completely, but you can always follow up with them more, always do more. And I do regret that a bit. Though I'm happy with where I am professionally. One thing about the future, I do not have kids, don't plan to have kids, and I just kind of wonder what that's going to be like at 80, and I've spent a lot of time cultivating my nephews. I have wonderful nephews,
yeah.
One wonderful niece. I want to make sure that regret doesn't happen. I want to have a great relationship with them.
In a few seconds, I really want to hear from you, Deborah Wong, because my regret or my advice to my younger self is don't worry. You know, I mean, the amount that we worry compared to what the actual odds are that the worst will happen, or the odds that we can't cope with that thing, it's just ridiculous. But Deborah, you told us several minutes ago you conquered that somehow.
Je
ne regrette rien.
I was just joking.
Oh,
because and that,
I wanted the answer.
If you knew me, you would realize what a big joke that is.
Je regrette beaucoup.
Well, I have a couple of regrets. One of them is, and maybe this is not something I regret at this very moment, but I think I will regret in the future, this idea of, you know, follow your passion. I mean, that's something like Knut that I have done my whole life. I love journalism. It's been a great career. I've had a lot of fun with it. But I worry about the future of journalism, and I worry what's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years or even next year with this profession of ours. I've had a good run, but, you know, we'll see what happens next. I also regret having children so late. I always thought, you know, I had a lot of fun in my 20s. I was out, you know, gallivanting around the world. I put off having children until much later than that. Yes. And now my children remind me every day, Mother, you're so old.
Yeah, but Deborah, I had a kid when I was 17, and we're both going to be elderly at the same time.
My only regret is that it's 11 o'clock. Deborah Wong, KOW reporter, Luke Burbank, LiveWire Radio, and TBTL, a great podcast, C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox News, Knut Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com, and Seattle Magazine, Todd Bishop of GeekWire, Roger Tang, Porkville Players was here. We've loved it. We'll do it again 10 o'clock Friday. Thank you, everybody.